Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
Guten Tag. Get it, guys? They call me Ben. You're you that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. And today, we're going to not quite flip the script, but let's say tilt it perpendicularly, in a perpendicular level, slightly to the right or left or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's an audio show. We're going to start with a listener suggestion rather than end with our typical shout-out corner, which we'll probably still do that too because we all think it's a lot of fun. We are pursuing a topic that people around the world have asked us to cover for several years. So we want to thank Aaron J., Carl L., and Avner B. Those are from 2016, 2015, and 2014, respectively.
Yeah. We also have our Australian mate, Stefan, who wrote to us about this
Stefan
very subject.
Stefan was Steve Urkel's suave alter ego.
Yes, precisely.
Mm-hmm. From Australia.
Mm-hmm. Well-known fact, did move to Australia and became a fan of our show.
He did.
Might be a different Stefan, but, you know, we'll have to wait for him to write back to let us know.
Yeah, it's takes a long time to get a letter from Melbourne.
Yes, Brisbane, Melbourne.
My father's name was Melbourne. Melvin was his real name.
Ah, got it, got it.
Close enough.
For anyone that knows the Pops.
And the subject of these emails fascinated us and hopefully will fascinate or at least interest many of you out there in podcast intangible audio land. We were inspired last week when we received the note from Stefan. Regardless of whether or not his past intersects with family matters, he raised a good point and he said, hey, what about the Nazi bell?
But Ben, before we do that, we have to mention Vault number 7, right?
Yeah, what's Vault number 7, you guys?
Oh, WikiLeaks, they're at it again. They've released a whole treasure trove of information on the CIA and their hacking techniques.
Those rascals over at WikiLeaks.
It's another one of the largest leaks in the history of leaks. And there's apparently another person that the media is referring to as the next Snowden, an insider that had all of these documents and leaked them all.
And Snowden has weighed in and believes these documents to be legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what?
What's
That's
that?
Not what we're talking about today. That's just a mention of what's happening in the news.
In the news. In the news. We just talked about something that was in the news.
And so you can expect perhaps an episode from us, more in-depth exploration of the recent CIA revelations. For now,
let's go back to those 40s.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. We're not talking about Nazis again, are we?
You did not see it coming, huh?
Yeah.
All right. So Nazis are a source of endless speculation in the world of alternative history and fringe research, right? In the past, we have explored the Nazi search for Shangri-La, the weird beliefs of Zannenberg in the occult, and even the idea that they searched for a subterranean civilization. That was crazy.
Oh, yeah. When they went to Antarctica and look for maybe reptilians, maybe not. Probably not.
Right. Or maybe some sort of Hyperborean elders civilization that was inexplicably Aryan.
Yep.
It is a fact, by the way, that they did land in a place and wanted to call it New Schwabia. However, the extent of any permanent settlement there, that's where you get into the fringe stuff. The point is, we have all these different strange things about the Nazi Party and the events leading up to and after World War II. And we've explored a lot of it in the past. You can check it out, shameless plug, on our website, stufftheydontwantyoutoknow.com.
Or on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast.
There we go. Nailed it.
That's the tag.
However you're listening to this.
If you are just meditating to some point where this is going into your brain, then I guess wherever you get your ohms.
If you prefer your podcast in suppository form, we can help you with that.
Nope. We actually can't. Sorry.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a DIY thing.
Yeah, we could give you the recipe.
We like morally support you. We will aid and abet.
So today we're looking at one of the most popular legends from the infamous Nazi regime. My theory is they had their fingers in so many different weird things because they just didn't have any scruples. They were just like, hey, we'll try it all. Whatever. And this time we're talking about a weapon. A sort of secret technology that allegedly not only surpassed all of the weaponry of the Allies at the time, but likely remains unsurpassed to this day. It's commonly referred to as Die Glucke or the Nazi Bell. To the Germans, it was called simply the Wunderwaffe.
Now, there are three people out there going, but you guys, you talked about Nazi weapons at some point. Ahaha, we talked about the Horten HO and a bunch of their rocket weaponry and some of the weird weapons.
That's right. In our very first podcast, huh?
Yes, that is correct.
Oh, boy.
One of them. But we never got into in depth about this Wunderwaffe, this very special one.
You may be aware of that Oasis song, Wunderwaffe, but this is not that Wunderwaffe.
And after awful, you're my Wunderwaffe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The strange thing about these Wunderwaffe is, all right, what does that mean for the non-German speakers? It is a wonder weapon. It's something that would have had the potential to shift the course of conflict in a serious and possibly final way. And
think it's, nuclear weapon.
Yeah. That would qualify. And it's important to understand that a lot of these super weapons were real, genuine things. And it's also important to note, we found this kind of funny in the research, that in German, sometimes calling something a Wunderwaffe is like a solution to all sorts of problems, an illusory panacea.
Whoa. This will fix a final solution?
Ouch.
I mean.
I was thinking more along the lines of snake oil.
Okay,
you know,
okay.
When they say someone's a snake oil salesman.
A cure-all.
And it turns out that we know a whole lot about these programs because as the war drew to a close, the Allied forces overran Germany and captured not only all of their, as much of their technology as possible in the forms of operational and prototype designs, but also a lot of documentation pertaining to those experiments and plans.
Unless we forget stealing or taking the scientists.
Yes, in Operation Paperclip, where, you know, easily 1,500 plus scientists were taken by the U.S. government, given new identities.
And started NASA.
Yeah, and started NASA. So really, the as we talked about in previous episodes, in some ways, the Nazi technology powered the space race. Well, actually, in pretty much conclusive ways, Nazi technology powered the space race or experimentation there. And the closest things to Nazi UFOs that have been proven to exist are pretty much U.S. space shuttles.
Yeah.
Or satellites, yeah. You know, and that's terrifying. But, you know, that's part of the way that technological progress works. Technology.
Yeah, the best rises to the top and then the conquerors take that best part.
Yeah. And technology is amoral. Technology does not favor one side of an ideology or another.
True.
Even ever since the days of fire and the wheel, wheels just roll and fire just burns, man.
Yep. And if you find a way to conquer those people that had the fire and the wheels, well, then guess what? You've got fire and wheels.
Well, you got that Bob Dylan song, "This Wheel's on Fire," rolling down the road. That is an image of destruction right there. You got a disembodied wheel. Where's the car? No one knows. And it's on fire and it's rolling down the road on its own.
So there's like a time sensitive decision to figure that out.
You're right.
You know? What, I think this was a very good analysis of Bob Dylan lyrics.
No, I'm just imagining seeing that image when you're unaware of what either a wheel or fire are as inventions.
Oh, yeah.
That would be an incredible experience.
You know, I never
experience.
Thought about that. I think that must be what Dylan had in mind, because those are the two biggest creations of man combined in a very stark visual.
In the Old Testament, some of the descriptions of divine visitations are like wheels of fire.
Yes.
So, right. Is that where you're going with it? And it ties into the idea of the mythology behind, you know, the cultural filters we use to explain things we don't understand, which happens today. There are some things that we don't understand about, aside from the horrific actions of the National Socialist Party, there's some things that are going to remain mysterious forever, because when it was clear what the outcome of the war would largely be, a lot of documents and paperwork were destroyed by Nazis because they knew that the capture was becoming imminent. It was the fall of the party. But
cyanide pills for the documents and for the other stuff.
Yeah, like this stuff that they burned primarily regarded activities that were going to be prosecuted as war crimes, like human experimentation. It's not a war crime to try to build a better tank.
No.
But it's a war crime to try to kill a huge population of people.
Or to experiment on them
in certain ways
that causes harm just outright.
So we do know, we do have some examples of these different wonder weapons. Pretty impressive stuff. There were aircraft carriers.
Sweet.
You know, the Germany was working on its own aircraft carriers, like the Graf Zeppelin, weighed over 33,000 tons. It's able to carry 42 aircraft, and it was scrapped. As we go through these wonder weapons, keep a list and see if you can identify some common themes here. Then there was a German aircraft carrier, one in 1942, would have been faster, larger than almost any of the other ships. This was actually a conversion. It was an existing watercraft, but they scrapped that again due to design issues. Turns out building aircraft carriers is tough.
Yeah. And that's why when they did actually come along and were utilized effectively, they ruled the seas.
Right. And currently still do, until the rise of asymmetrical warfare. China is doing some of probably the most impressive research on that as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then they attempted to build battleships that would be super weapons. And perhaps one of the most famous of the Wunderwaffe is the V program. The rockets.
Yeah, this program consisted of a particular group of long-range artillery weapons that were designed for strategic bombing during WW2, particularly terror bombing or aerial raids, like the kinds of images you get of an air raid siren, planes coming in London, and just bombs falling everywhere. And it's literally designed to keep the population terrified and cowering.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of versions of the V as well that you can find. I would say just go to Wikipedia if you want to, because you can click through and see all the different images of them, and you'll eventually get to, or you'll probably start at, the V2 rocket. That's the most well known.
Yeah, it's the breakout single.
Yeah, exactly. But it went through all kinds of different, like, attempts, because you're literally trying to build a thing that can use fire to propel itself across, you know, hundreds at least of miles, sometimes thousands of miles, and explode on something with accuracy.
The precursor to ICBMs, right?
Yes.
So yeah, the V1 was just called a flying bomb, and the V2 is the one that really, as Noel mentioned, really brought the terror to London and to other areas of conflict. But that wasn't just it. This was a land, air, and sea thing.
We can't forget the submarines, the U-boats. Tell me about those, Ben. I remember hearing about them in school, how they were just so versatile and nimble. And incredibly important strategically for the Germans.
Yeah, U-boats were incredibly – you nailed it. U-boats were a crucial piece of the German offensive and of the defensive lines, because they could – if everything worked out as it was supposed to, right, in theory, they could neutralize the threat or do what's called area denial for – boats that would travel above water. Of course, armored vehicles, gigantic tanks, huge tanks. We're talking tanks with crews of 40 to 100 people in one tank.
And that's too many
people. And a railway gun. Yeah. Yeah. I think it is too.
Was this like the Panzers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. These were Panzers. Some of those really big ones never made it to a construction phase. They were just prototypes, or they were scrapped later, because the entire time that the party is, or the scientists are working on these astonishing breakthroughs in technology, the clock is ticking and the tide is turning against them. So they're spontaneously becoming more and more of a panic mode, because the management — I'm sure anyone who has a job is familiar with management coming down hard on you. Management is telling them, you know, how long do you think this will take? Somebody says, I guess in a German accent, 10 years. And they go, cool, you've got 3 weeks.
Okay.
What are you going to do?
And at that point, though, it all becomes just a fool's errand. You know, you sometimes when you get managers like that that are going into panic mode, they know damn well these are not realistic goals, but they're going to try to terrify their underlings to the point where they – give them something.
right, exactly.
I just want to get to one of these monster huge tanks.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Can I say real quick, though, I've got to say this word. I love these amazing German compound words. The Panzer tanks, the full longhand version of that word is Panzerkampfwagen, which means armored combat vehicle. I just am a huge fan of these amazing compound German words.
Kampfwagen sounds like a station wagon you would get from Volkswagen.
It does. And you know what you can also get from there?
What's that?
A Land Cruiser. That's another one. There's one called the Land Cruiser P1500 Monster. It's just a prototype, like an idea, essentially. I don't think anything ever really got created, but it would have been so massive that it would have used these 800 millimeter shells. And if you look at one of these shells, and you look at a human man who is probably 5'10", 5'11", standing there, it's at least like 2.2 of that person, when you look at its height. It's a massive shell that would have caused crazy havoc if you ever were to fire this thing, if it were ever built.
Right. And it sounds like, just from an engineering perspective, launching a projectile like that with such force would probably have a significant amount of damage on the frame of the vehicle, right?
Yeah, and probably catastrophic effects to the surroundings of where the vehicle is placed.
Well, don't put it in a good neighborhood. No. This is war.
But if you can imagine this type of weapon, you can really see a picture of, I guess, what the leadership wanted, to have these massive super weapons placed – all over countries where, you know, on, I can imagine them protecting the ships or something, just sitting on the edge of some giant cliff. It's pretty terrifying of an alternate future where that happened.
Right. Well, you know, people could argue that the world has more or less been in a continual state of war, just in regions, right? And war between countries. Those things are still out there, maybe not on that scale, but they're happening, right? And some of it, some of the things that are just as dangerous in their own way are global information collecting nets.
Yeah.
People didn't stop tinkering. You know, we brought up Operation Paperclip before. One thing that's amazing though is I think a lot of people, at least in the West, don't realize just how influential Nazi era science was, or Axis science, if we count Unit 731 from mm-hmm. Japan, in medicine, in rocketry, in U-boat design, you know, submarine design. They really did change the world. They built the first fixed-wing plane.
I'm not trying to downplay the intelligence of the German people and the ingenuity, because we do know they have great technology, but I really do stand by, especially medically, some of those advances came from having no scruples, willing to do whatever it took.
The vast majority of them, I completely agree. And it's, you know, there's this question that we have asked ourselves before, you know, what would you do if you're a military official? Let's say you're the Surgeon General for some reason. It's a very dark time to be Surgeon General. And you say, we have all these files. This is the best, most thorough and current research of what happens to people at high atmospheric pressure, because they took civilians and put them in there and repeated the experiment until they, like, as the people exploded. Is it exploiting that horrific occurrence, that horror movie level stuff, to use it? Or is it in some ways trying to make some sort of good out of the situation, you know? And honestly, ladies and gentlemen, whatever your call would have been at that time, the fact of the matter is that not just the U.S., but also Russia, also the other allied powers, took the research and used it. You know, it had tremendous influence on the Air Force. But you're absolutely right. Like, what is the ethical line when you're trying to behave ethically, but the best information you will ever run into in your career comes from people who are, ethically speaking, like, not people.
Subhuman.
Yeah,
completely.
Monstrous.
Yeah.
Or thought they were better than human, but we run into that. It pops up pretty
it's tough. I kind of say you take it, you run with it, you make it right, you make it good. You honor the memory of those people that suffered in order to achieve these innovations by making it better and using it to ensure that stuff like that never happens again. That's just me.
I absolutely agree. And I think if we had, Matt and I had discussed this before and came to the same conclusion. I mean, you can't bring those people back, but you can save other people.
You also can't unknow that science.
Well, yeah, and it feels
that's
like
true.
That's so true. It feels like if you lock it away in a grimoire somewhere, all that information, or you burn it and it is never to be found again, someone else is going to come along.
Maybe someone bad.
And perform the same experimentation to find out the same answers that were gained there. God, that's so messed up.
History is a messed up place, and we are going through history at this point.
So the Nazis also had gliders.
Yes. Yeah. That, in addition to atrocities, right? First fixed wing gliders. Matt, you mentioned the Horton HO.
Mm-hmm.
This was something that would have absolutely looked like some kind of Delta wing UFO.
Sure.
If you had seen it flying.
Consequently, it was the inspiration for the Dr. Seuss book, Horton Hears an H-O.
Yes. Yeah. Which has been a lot of people got that one wrong.
That would have been a much scary book.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I'd read it. I would read it. Yeah, so we know that there were these advances, these tremendous advances or attempts with aircraft and gliders as well, including stuff that would be in very, very high orbit. But one of the craziest ones, while we're going through this this hall of fame and infamy, one of the craziest ones was the idea of something called a sun gun.
Oh, dude.
I know we're a family show, so I shoot you not. Gentlemen, this was a real thing. A group of German scientists at the German Army Artillery Proving Grounds at Hillersleben began conceiving a super weapon that could use the sun's energy, that could weaponize solar energy, which is, of course, for fans of Planet Earth or Life or those documentaries, of course, it is the engine that powers pretty much every living thing or every reaction on the planet, except for that one naturally occurring nuclear power plant,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So this sun gun, the idea is that it would be part of a space station that's like 5,000 miles above Earth. And the scientists thought that if they got a huge reflector made of metallic sodium that was 3.5 square miles wide, they could produce enough focused heat to how James Bond villain is,
yeah,
this, to boil an ocean, to burn a city, just with concentrated sun power.
Melt a face?
Oh, every face.
Yeah.
Every face.
Yeah. Imagine I've seen a million faces and I melted them all with my sun gun.
Is that a Tenacious D reference?
No, it's a Bon Jovi reference.
No, with the references today.
Sorry,
you're just ruling.
Jovi with the sun gun, I think, really is the point. That's that's like a lot of people don't know that, but Bon Jovi did come out of the sun gun research, you know. And it's one of those ethical decisions where the U.S. government said,
it's like, do we deprive the population at large from this rock?
Right.
Or, you know, what do we do?
So many innocent people died to you know, produce this album.
Powerhouse of rock.
So I'm going back and I'm wondering, did everybody have this same revelation of the power you can wield in your hand with a magnifying glass when the sun is out? Like, did you guys discover that? Were you told that? Because this, whoever, you know, these scientists are, they thought about that and then they imagined, well, what if God had a magnifying glass and we were God?
Such a German question.
Right. I don't know. That's so messed up. Just imagining I can kill these ants with my magnifying glass, or I can light this leaf on fire with my magnifying glass. Well, what if we did it to the whole planet?
Yeah. Big old magnifying glass.
Yeah. I always thought that the only ethical human experimentation is self-experimentation. I've had ups and downs in that regard, but I did the thing on myself.
On your hand?
Yeah. To see how long it would take.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Did you get a scar?
I got some smoke. I felt really cool. It was worth it.
Mmm. Delicious.
I don't know why I keep thinking of this, probably because I watched it last night. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. That feels like a Nazi weapon.
Wait, the movie?
Yes. The movie. The shrinking gun. Even the look of it. It's got this like kind of steampunk kind of weird, like the coils and exposed metal. It seems like something the Nazis would have been hip to. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is a great movie. All of the iterations of it, I think I enjoyed all of them.
Wait, there's more than two?
Aren't there
Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves, Honey, We Shrunk the Kids.
Well, no. Kids was first.
Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves.
Oh, yeah. In no particular order.
Selves was third, I guess. I remember the second one was Honey, I Blew Up the Baby.
That's right.
Right. With the big baby. There were at least three.
Okay. That one, not so much.
Third one wasn't straight to video?
Yeah, Honey, We Shrunk the Budget.
Honey, I don't remember my childhood.
So out of all of these proven weapons and pieces of technology, like the Horton H.O. or the V-2 rockets or the propaganda dynasty known as Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, or prototype super weapons, one in particular gets by far the most attention from fringe theorists around the world, and we will dive into the story behind that after a word from our sponsors.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now begins the legend of the Nazi Bell. In 2000, a Polish author named Igor Witkowski published a book called Prawda o Wunderwaffel, or The Truth About the Wonder Weapon. And guess what? I didn't pronounce that correctly. This was reprinted in German as Die Wehrhaub. Not even going to try that. It was reprinted in German. So this is the first public printed mention of what this guy calls the Nazi Bell. And here is what he claims. While conducting some research, he happened upon these transcripts from the interrogation of a Nazi SS officer named Jacob Sporenberg. And inside this transcript, he found the first mention of this thing that was called the bell. Although it was in German, and I can't do it correctly, so... Die Glocke.
So he did all this during his time as SS and police leader of Lublin in the general government of occupied Poland in August of 1943. Then he was captured after a relocation to Norway and was extensively questioned. Spornberg was extradited to Poland in October of 1946 and then sentenced to death by a Polish court in Warsaw in 1950. The sentence was carried out on December 6th of 1952 when he was executed by hanging. And according to Witkowski, he was shown these allegedly classified transcripts in August of 1997 by an unnamed Polish intelligence contact who said he had access to Polish government documents regarding Nazi secret weapons. So Witkowski maintains that he was only allowed to transcribe the document and was not actually allowed to make any copies. So no photos, no primary source documentation, and the legend was popularized by an author named Nick Cook, who used Witkowski's stories in his own book on Zero Point Energy.
So there's a lot to unpack here, right? This guy was allegedly shown these documents, shown these transcripts, and it seems like that might be a big red light that's flashing and tells you, okay, he's shown these things, but he can't document them whatsoever. Okay, it makes you wonder about the intentions, if it's true, the intentions of the person that showed it to him. And, you know, it also makes you wonder, is this real?
Right. So, yeah, there's a weak spot in the argument there. The first mention of this bell, whatever it might be, doesn't arrive until decades after the war.
Yeah, 97.
Right. So when would this – well, even if we just say that the author says it happened in 1997, that he was shown these things, the book comes out in 2000.
Yeah.
So it depends on, you know, how much of this person's word we want to take for sacrosanct fact. We do know that there were Nazi secret weapons because Allied powers found a lot of them. We do know that in some classified situations or dealing with compartmentalized information, as they would call it in the U.S., that there are, you know, situations where people are not allowed to take photographic evidence or to be provided copies. I mean, this is a country where the Supreme Court, which has immense power, doesn't get filmed.
Yeah.
You know, there are no cameras in the courtroom when the ring wraiths are in session.
Oh God.
What? There's nine of them. Or, you know, there are
there
nine
will be,
spots.
There will be
there
nine.
There are nine spots.
Yeah.
So they're looking for the next ring bearer. But, but also an important detail here is that Spornberg is dead. There's no record of him saying anything about this any other time. And there's no way with current technology that we can ask him. So what the heck is this thing? It wasn't even around, and even though it was in 2000, it wasn't really around in English much until the author Nick Cook made a book looking into people, inventors, entrepreneurs who felt like they had discovered various forms of alternate energy, right? Zero point energy, mm-hmm. anti-gravity, stuff like that. All that jazz, all that smooth jazz.
Something that'll change the game again.
Right. So what the heck? What in Sam Hill? What in Sweet Stinky Pete is this Nazi bell thing? Allegedly, it was an experiment carried out by Third Reich scientists working for the SS in a secret German facility known as Der Reis, or the Giant. It's in the Wenceslas Mine and was close to the Czech border.
You think it's the same king, like from the Christmas song, Good King Wenceslaus? Was it his mine, his personal mine?
The very same, unless, I mean, like, at least etymologically speaking.
Who knew he was a Nazi sympathizer?
I feel like it's implied in the song.
I'm going to have to revisit that text.
I did say that without having read the lyrics of Good. I apologize to the king.
Good King Wenceslaus looked out on the feast of Stephen.
I honestly have no idea what you're talking about.
When the moon lay round about, deep and crisp and even.
And panzers.
What is this?
It's a Christmas song.
Yeah.
What?
Christmas is a holiday typically celebrated at the end of the Gregorian year.
And invented by the Nazis.
And that's a totally different thing too. Side note, if we have time, I don't want to take up too much time. But side note, the Nazi party did have a group of – like an ideological group that was trying to supplant Christian celebrations with a more – what they felt was traditionally Germanic – based mythos and celebration. We've got to look into that. I think we did in the past, right? Did we talk about that? Was Sandenberg?
I get our videos and our audio mixed up sometimes, so we'll have to look at it.
Point being, and you can find it. It's an amazing story. But point being, yes, this bell. What the heck is it? What in good King Wenceslaus is going on here? Well, we have to look at a guy called General Dr. Hans Friedrich Karl Franz Kammler, who oversaw the V-2 rocket programs. He was born in 1901. By the end of the Second World War, he was almost as powerful as SS Chief Heinrich Himmler and the armaments minister, who is Albert Speer. He had access to the Nazis' most advanced technology, including the V-1 and V-2 rockets and... These things are some of the only – those rockets are some of the only weapons that came out in enough time to actually rain destruction, right? The design didn't get rushed into a point where it was non-viable. But as a lot of military historians tell you, it came down to, you know, a matter of a couple years or months. If more of this technology rolled out, the war could have ended differently. This was the guy in charge of a lot of that.
This General Kammler.
Yes, yes. And in addition to designing and supervising secret weapons, because he was also an engineer, he also approved and designed crematoriums in Auschwitz and he was associated with some of the darkest, most disturbing things.
It's a pretty broad skill set of evil.
Yeah, right. He's a utility evil player. But his the primary thing he was known for at the time was supervising the secret weapon programs. And this German facility in this mine was a real thing. Right. The bell, right? The bell is the question. The maddening tintinnabulation of hearsay and rumor and the telephone game we call history. Here's what Witkowski, as told by Cook, says the bell appears to be. Says it's made out of a hard, heavy metal, approximately 9 feet wide, 12 to 15 feet high. And it's similar in shape to that of a large church bell or handbell. So, you know, it's got a bigger lip or rim at the bottom, and then it tapers up to a rounded top.
The nipple.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the nipple, which is the technical term. You know, and there are various kinds of bells. So, you know, there are like carillon bells, which are tubular. We don't want to mislead you. Think about the Liberty Bell. Think about
big old steel bell.
Yeah. Huge, heavy contraptions. So it looks like that. And according to Witkowski or Cook's account of interviewing Witkowski, this device had two counter-rotating cylinders. So one would be – or they both be filled with a mercury-like substance, which was violet in color. And it was codenamed Zirum 525 with – that's Zirum with an X. And it was stored in a small, thin flask that was about a meter high and encased in lead. So they also said that there were additional substances used in the experiments referred to as light metal, and they included things like thorium and beryllium peroxides. That's a quote.
Wow. So reactive things, things that like could perhaps be nuclear powered if you use them in a certain way.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So Witkowski says to Cook, he says, this bell, when they activated it, it also needed a tremendous amount of power. He says that when they activated it, it had what he called an effect zone that extended 490 to 660 feet. And that seems like an arbitrary measurement in feet, but that's because, you know, this is in Europe and in every other part of the world, except for Myanmar and the US. And I think Namibia, everybody else uses the metric system. So we said 150 to 200 meters. So what would happen when this effect zone was, in full effect, when it was charged up, cooking with Zerum 525?
Well, allegedly, if you're an animal and you have cells of an animal, blood of an animal, it would form into crystals. And like blood would turn into gel and separate, while plants would just turn into this greasy, I guess a grease-like substance, something that just looks nasty.
Kind of like in Troll 2. When they would eat the green goo, and they turned into plants, and then they would disintegrate into a puddle of greenish snot goo.
That's pretty good. Yeah. Or like when people, would.
You guys have seen Troll 2, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I actually have it on my computer now.
Nice. For reference.
Kind of tuned out. Yeah. It's kind of like Indiana Jones, when they look at the Ark of the Covenant, right?
Yeah.
I think Troll 2 is probably, if we're aiming for accuracy in our film references, and Troll 2 is probably better because they do end up being goo at the end of the troll process.
Here's one of the worst parts about testing a weapon like this. When there's an effect zone and you have to manipulate the stuff and turn it on and make adjustments, well, sometimes, and in this case, according to this gentleman, the scientists become victims. There were five of the seven original scientists allegedly died over the course of testing this thing.
And now we get to some of the architecture here. So Witkowski states that there are the ruins near the Wenceslas mine. There are ruins of a concrete framework, and there's one thing called the hinge. This looks like a frame with hooks attached that make people think it was the spot to test a vehicle of some sort or some kind of engine, something that had propellant abilities.
And it's called the Henge because it's reminiscent, well, very slightly reminiscent to Stonehenge, because it is a constructed, an obviously constructed thing of stone.
Yeah.
But they're standing rocks.
And it is right next to a former secret underground research facility made by the Nazi parties, made by a state actor at the time, which was also made using slave labor. I feel like we have to point that out. If you are in the vicinity and you would like to check this out and maybe send your old pals at Conspiracy Stuff some photographic evidence, while you, of course, avoid any possible field effects, you can find the mine with the coordinates that I will read to you now. It's 50 degrees 37 43 north and 16 degrees 29 40 east.
Dude,
there you have it. So people who believe in this Nazi Bell idea believe that they see this structure as evidence that there was actual experimentation with maybe some sort of anti-gravity propulsion, maybe some sort of other advanced application of physics that we perhaps don't yet understand.
Yeah. The anti-gravity thing is what I've heard most, or the zero-point energy idea, that this thing, once you turned it on, it started generating its own power. It took a lot of energy to turn it on.
Right.
But once it's on, it's like, hey, we're going to run forever.
Yeah, it was like Mick Jagger and Start Me Up. However, for people who think this is not true, that structure itself is just another ruin. And they say, well, if it looks like anything, it looks like a cooling tower, right? Mm-hmm. So the really crazy part, what was it supposed to do? We've mentioned it being like thought of as a weapon. We've mentioned it being thought of as a vehicle. But what gives? What's the skinny?
Can we cliffhang here for a sec? Sponsor break.
Hey, girlfriends. It's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, you know, as a lot of these reports are, we are pretty much entering the realm of wild speculation. If I didn't have a shoulder injury, I would be gesticulating wildly. So everything after the original claim by Witkowski itself is completely unsupported. It delves into pretty arbitrary or at least unproven territory. But that has never stopped us on this show. So let us sally forth. For example, in the book, Hitler's Suppressed and Still Secret Weapons, Science and Technology, author Henry Stevens concludes that the violet mercury-like substance described by Witkowski could only be red mercury, because normal mercury, quote, has no fluid compounds, according to conventional wisdom. So what is red mercury, Ben?
I'm so glad you asked.
The stuff that's in the thermometers, right?
That's what I thought about too initially.
That's mercury. The difference between those mercuries is that the mercury in your thermometers is real. It's a real proven thing. Red mercury, at least at this point, is a hoax substance. And You can tell in some ways because the author, Stevens, his source for this claim is, of course, as Noel said, conventional wisdom, right?
Yep.
Many people have had worse things happen because of their conventional wisdom. What's that old saying about common sense being the rarest thing? There was an interesting article that talks a little bit about red mercury because for a while, there's a little bit of intrigue in here, okay? So for a while, there was this idea that separatist groups or terrorist groups or militias around the world would be able to get their hands on a substance that they called red mercury, and they thought was very, very dangerous. And it turned out that there's pretty convincing evidence that whomever was making this red mercury claim was a state intelligence agency, a state actor, possibly one of Uncle Sam's boys who was doing like a sting operation on these people. So it had all these rumors about its potency, how dangerous and rare it was, how it could create the equivalent of a nuclear bomb blast.
Yeah, because it's an explosive, right? A non-exploding explosive, so one that's safe to handle, but then will explode when, I guess, activated. And
I love the idea of a non-exploding explosive. It just seems like a gag gift.
Yeah. Can't call it a dud.
I wanted an explosive that actually explodes.
We got you.
Wow.
Well, that's like a terrorist prank.
You rascals. Yeah.
But in this case, it's almost the equivalent of a nuclear explosion if you had enough of this stuff, at least according to the legends.
If it were real.
But it's almost like yellow cake is something I remember hearing about.
Sure.
Back in the day and not knowing at all what it was and just having crazy ideas because I hadn't done any research on what yellow cake was. I feel like you hear something like red mercury. I don't know. Maybe the same thing applies. You think it must be real.
Yeah, that's part of the cleverness behind those kinds of manipulative things is you have this idea of two things that you understand conceptually.
Like, yeah.
I know what mercury is. I'm aware of the color red. And you put them together and then it seems somehow still understandable because they're not contradictory, right?
Yeah.
So it's an understandable but distressing thing. At this point, if we're being completely fair, at this point, there is no universally accepted proof of something called red mercury. That is the most fair we can be about it. But let us not stop there, because Stevens further alleges that there is a concave mirror. Here's how he says it. He relays an anecdote from a guy who, when he was 13, in the 1960s, the scientists told him about a device that had a concave mirror on the top of it, and the description of it matched, in the author's opinion, or maybe in the person he's interviewing's opinion, it matched the description of the bell, and that this concave mirror provided the ability to see, quote, images from the past during its operation. And this line of thought led other authors to claim the bell is some sort of time traveling technology or time viewing device, kind of like the Palantir in Lord of the Rings, you know, a deadly crystal ball.
I'm getting images of Contact, the movie Contact, where there's this device that spins really fast and then you can drop something through it and it can time travel through time, I guess, or in some way.
I see. Yeah, because they say only 8 minutes passed.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I'm imagining the bell being these two spinning things, mm-hmm. and then maybe you can even drop something through it, or maybe the person inside of it is time traveling if you can climb in it.
Well, I'm immensely glad that you mentioned UFOs, Matt, or aliens or extraterrestrials, mm-hmm. because if you happen to check out things on the Discovery Network or History Channel, their infamous love to hate it, hate to love it, program Ancient Aliens, you'll see that the Nazi bell is associated with UFOs in those things. And we'll get to that in just a second. It all really goes back to the idea of where this thing ended up, right? So we've got Kammler disappears after the war, people say he commits suicide, and that's the official story. But what really happened is he disappeared. And the world's going to heck in a handbasket for Germany. So they have to get rid of this technology, right? And obviously no one found a bell and went public with it. So according to people who believe in its existence, this either ended up in South America, and that's related to a lot of other fringe theories, and some fringe facts that we are already aware of. You probably have heard this a million times if you check out our, if you enjoy our show, and that is the idea of Nazis escaping World War II through the Vatican, at times Vatican-sponsored rat lines, and living out, in some isolated cases, living their entire natural lives out punishment-free in areas of South America. So people who believe that the bell was a real thing but hasn't been found think that Kammler brought it with him or somehow sent it to South America, where it resides, just imagine, folks, in the jungle today. Stay away from bells in the woods, regardless of what size they are. Just in general, if it's not your bell, don't touch it. Or it ended up somewhere else.
What if it ended up in Kentucky, y'all?
Ah, yes, Kentucky, the logical, the logical destination.
There's this thing that we may have touched on before here. I know we've touched on it in our video series, the Kecksburg incident. This is a UFO, an unidentified flying object that came down in 1965 on December 9th. It was originally thought to be a meteorite, or called a meteorite. That's what it was thought to be. Well, current researchers believe that this was a GE Mark II, that's General Electric, re-entry vehicle that was launched by the Air Force as a spy satellite, which, very plausible in my opinion. Unfortunately, this one just fell out of orbit and then landed in Kentucky, as it does.
Yeah, but originally, of course,
Kentucky gets all the meteors and fallen satellites. And,
yeah.
But there's a lot of hubbubaloo. I don't know how to say that.
Is this a Hubble joke?
There's a, yeah, I was trying
hullabaloo?
To. Hullabaloo?
Hullabaloo.
Hubblebaloo.
Hubblebaloo.
More like hillbilly baloo.
But of course, there was a lot of hullabaloo at the time when the Kecksburg incident occurred, because this thing was bright and it sure appeared to enter the atmosphere and then crash somewhere. And people were like, oh man, it's a UFO, you guys.
Well, and technically it is.
Yeah. Well,
it's unidentified.
It was a flying saucer that crashed, Holmes.
Right. The Holmes, as they called each other. But be that as it may, pun-making prodigies though we may be, there is an unfunny and inescapable truth here, which is, of course, the government most likely lied to these people. The Kecksburg incident is different because civilians got there first.
Yes.
And we're able to look at this in detail. But imagine if you're a state power, right? You have to control what your enemies would see or what other people would see, right? So having a spy satellite fall, first off, very fortunate for it to fall in the contiguous U.S. But you have to get that out because you don't want other people talking about something that, you know, your rivals in the USSR or what have you will immediately recognize when they hear it described. So as far as we know now, it was probably the satellite that Matt described. But at the time, you can't blame people for thinking this is a Tunguska event all over again, or this is a piece of alien technology, because who at that time would have seen a satellite up close?
And by the way, guys, we have an entire audio episode on the Kecksburg incident if you're interested and you want to learn more about it. We've described everything that happened
in more detail.
Yeah, check it out. Go there now when you're done with this.
But be kind.
Yes.
It was an earlier time.
So? It was awesome.
Well, this is an awesome thing, this idea that there could be technology that's beyond what we even possess today in 2017. And, of course, this is just my opinion, and I don't know how you guys feel about this, but I'm pretty convinced. I have certitude that the technology that militaries have is at the minimum several years in advance of the civilian stuff. Just
absolutely
in general, right?
I think it's compounded over time too.
We never really knew the top speed of the
SR-71.
Yeah, right. Until it was in museums.
Yep.
You know, or was retired.
Or about how it expanded its metal and stuff. It was designed so it could expand because it got so hot and went so fast.
I just want a 1,000,000 terabyte thumb drive. When can I have that?
I guess when you start working for DARPA, man.
What's 1,000,000 terabytes? That's a name for that, right? Is that a...
That's a lot.
HEPA-byte? A PEPA-byte?
I think they call it king-sized.
A bagel bite?
Someone write to us, Conspiracy at HowStuffWorks, and let us know what a 1,000,000 terabyte drive would be.
All right, man. We'll get back on track. I apologize.
No, I want to know.
So we have all these questions. This story leaves us with more questions. Some of them are psychological. Some of them are material. And some of them are a little bit more philosophical. So it's true that we will never have complete answers to many questions surrounding World War II. If you believe that a lot of people disappeared in the Vietnam War, first, you are correct, but World War II had probably even more people just wiped off the face, or even more soldiers went missing, right? We know, for example, that the thing that we all grew up being taught was Hitler's skull by in possession of the Soviet Party, I believe, was not, in fact, his skull.
No, it was a female, but there was a jaw, part of a jaw that was found that was supposedly Hitler's. That was identified by people at the time, at least according to Skeptoid, which is what I was reading.
And this feeds into, you know, this feeds into the propagation of theories of Hitler escaping and living to be somewhere else, living his natural life out somewhere else, maybe South America. But if we can't arrive immediately at good answers, we can ask increasingly well-informed questions. So the first question about this particular device that sounds straight out of science fiction, right, uses either an ancient power source descended from Vril and the flying machines, right, that appear in the Bhagavad Gita and are rediscovered in some sort of occult field trip on the side of the Nazi party, or some space age thing that had never been built on Earth before. If either way, if it's so advanced, here's question number one. Why did the Axis lose the war?
Yeah.
If they had UFOs, if there were underground bases, if there was revolutionary technology, then why did they lose the war?
Well, first of all, it melted all the scientists, so they couldn't finish the thing.
Five out of seven. Maybe the good ones.
Yeah, and the last two were like, F this.
Associate scientists.
It was like this first day.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Research assistants.
I think that's an answer.
And okay.
Assuming the SS officer really did mention some sort of device like the bell in an interrogation, how much could he have actually known or understood? Sure, he was a notoriously bad person and an effective at what he did in the military, but nothing he did had a technical or scientific role in his entire career.
Yeah.
So it's possible that he could have seen something and been mistaken. It's possible that he could have never mentioned it.
Yep.
It's possible there could have been some miscommunication. And then Kamler, the guy who's in charge of the V-2 rockets, in this case, we do have an answer. Officially, he committed suicide at the end of the war, yet growing evidence indicates that the U.S. faked his death, gave him a brand new identity in America, secretly using his knowledge of weaponry to advance their own studies, which means that he was never prosecuted. And this is never prosecuted in a country that will lock people up for life for nonviolent drug offenses, right?
Yeah.
In a country that has three strike offenses to the point where, you know, children can be locked up for the better part of their natural life.
So whatever happened to that giant underground complex? Well, it remains in ruins today, unfinished, just kind of hanging out, sitting there. And get this, it's only one of the just multiple underground storage facilities that the Nazis built at the time.
You know there's some magic alien crystals buried in that mess somewhere.
Well, it's possible that there's undiscovered stuff like that out there. It's possible, like tiny, itty, tiny bit possible. But it's been a long time, right? It's been decades. Mm. There are governments that would have an interest in anything, any kind of technology or magic that may exist out there. And you'd think that they would go through it, but maybe not.
And we do know that Kamler was in charge of, you know, 8 or 9 of these things. They were dug out pretty extensively because it was one of the only ways to protect this sort of secret experimental research from Allied bombers.
Well, I mean, it's not like documents they could have shredded, you know, like when the jig was up and the Nazis were being toppled and everyone was coming in, mm-hmm. ransacking their facilities, their bunkers, what have you. It would be pretty difficult to cover their tracks on something this large.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, but it could be like the tombs, like King Tut's tombs or other tombs that are yet to be discovered that just maybe we haven't used the LIDAR technology on it yet in these areas, you know, to find the secret bunker parts inside the secret bunker.
You were all about that LIDAR.
I mean, it's one of the coolest technologies that exists right now, I think.
And so there we are concluding for now our story of the Nazi Bell. We looked into this extensively and without saying that it's like a purposeful hoax or anything, the best we can say is that we found evidence of very, very strange things like these underground facilities, right? And we know that had the timing worked out differently, the technological advances that Germany was researching at the time could well have changed the tide of war, including the research into nuclear weapons, nuclear warheads specifically. And they were much closer than a lot of people might imagine. But we couldn't find anything about the Nazi Bell before the year 2000, 1997, if you want to be, you know, if you want to entirely accept the claims made in the book. We would like to hear what you think about the Nazi Bell. If you'd like to learn more about this from maybe a more conspiratorial angle, check out The Brotherhood of the Bell. Check out the other two books we mentioned here. And most importantly, if you have some ideas or some insight that we haven't heard yet, we'd love to hear from you. And speaking of listeners, just like you, it's time for
Shout Out Corners.
Our first shout out today comes from Alex H. Alex says, I'm listening to your Grimoire episode now, and I thought I would send you something of insider perspective. Something of an insider's perspective, he says. I had Narnia and Middle Earth as my bedtime stories from a young age. Once I could read, I devoured the mythology and folklore sections of my local library. I was raised Catholic, but after my mother became very ill in my teenage years, I had a crisis of faith and began to doubt what I had been told. When I got to college, I discovered weed, LSD, and mushrooms, as you do. You know, mm-hmm. whatever tickles your third eye. And it really altered what I believed was possible. I read Grant Morrison's comic book series, The Invisibles, huge favorite of the show, around the same time and was enthralled by its wild, experimental, psychosexual, spiritual spy conspiracy story. That is a mouthful. Try as I might, and I really did, after that, I couldn't just put the genie back in the bottle. So I tried Buddhism for a while and yoga and the whole milieu that comes with that, but it never completely squared with my worldview. Western occultism is the only thing that has. Ultimately, what it comes down to is the fact that belief is a choice. A belief in and the practice of magic works for me. It is anecdotal. Much of it is psychological. And obviously, it stands against the dominant paradigm of modern society. But the simple fact is, when I am practicing, I feel happy and engaged with the world in a way that I do not under normal circumstances. Severe depression has been a condition of my existence for much of my life. And if the fix for that is something most people would consider crazy, so be it. It's worth it to live in an enchanted world. It's a beautiful sentiment. Anyway, those are my 2 cents. Love the podcast. Keep up the great work. I couldn't agree more. I'm not a religious person myself. I begrudge no one that practices religion if they do so respectfully of others and it is something that works for them and keeps them on a path they find to be, you know, successful mentally and spiritually. It doesn't work for me, but I see plenty of people in my life that use religion as a tool to kind of guide their lives in an ordered way, and this is no different in my opinion.
Thanks so much for writing in, Alex H. That is a beautiful sentiment. I think we all agree here.
Yeah, and we definitely share your from childhood interest in the folklore and mythology section at the library.
So who's next?
Our next message comes from Kelsey. Says, hey guys, I'm a new listener and I've been going back through the archive and catching up on old episodes. I got to the cannibalism one and y'all said you were wondering what your listeners were doing while they were listening about such a dark subject. Well, I'm an electrical engineer student doing research with semiconductors, and I like listening to your podcasts while I catalog samples, read papers, do homework, etc. Today, while I was cataloging and listening, I got a surprise phone interview for a full-time position after I graduate. Congratulations, Kelsey. That is a huge accomplishment and such good news. It went well, but it's hard to talk about green technology when you just heard about someone's testicles being fed to them.
Oh, cannibalism. Yeah, yeah.
Yum.
Yeah. sorry
this
about
episode
that, Kelsey.
Brought to you by Blue Apron.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Sorry, Kelsey, but you know, we are very glad that you got that good news. Kelsey says, love the podcast. P.S. I'll let you know if I get it. Well, we certainly hope you do.
We're sending you good vibes unanimously and immensely and profoundly, sending good vibes. I gotta say, your comment regarding testicles and cannibalism reminds me, I do a live show on Facebook called Snack Stuff where we try strange and weird snacks from around the world. You could check it out Tuesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every couple of weeks. And we also have a food show that's come out, which I can say is good because I'm not part of it. It's called Food Stuff. It's about the science and culture of everything wonderful, weird, delicious, and gustatory. But
neither of those shows have covered cannibalism yet.
Right.
Give it time. They'll run into topics.
Have you eaten testicles yet on Snack Stuff?
I have not.
I'll like to volunteer, Matt's. Oh, and point of order, lest we not forget, the month of March is Tripod Month. That's with a Y. Try a pod cast.
That's right. Hashtag tripod.
Hashtag that. Try it, then hashtag it. Use the hashtag tripod when you're tweeting out your favorite podcast recommendations for your friends, whoever. And so today I've got one. I'm a big fan of the podcast How Did This Get Made?
Yes.
With Paul Scheer and Jason Mantzoukas from The League, and also Paul's hilarious wife, June Diane Raphael, where they basically just riff and rip on crappy movies.
Yeah, they all get together. They'll watch it separately or together and then just talk about it. And it is hilarious. They're part of the Earwolf group of podcasts. And some of my favorite, if I ever go on a trip, I've got that show and Comedy Bang Bang and several others of theirs just rocking in my car. Can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, for sure. So get out there and try a pod.
They did Hackers not long ago, by the way.
Oh, Hackers is the best. That's the one where June doesn't understand what the little BB-8 toy's mission is. She's like, what's its mission? And everyone just cracks up because it's like, what's its mission? It's wonderful.
Nobody knows.
You never know what's going to happen. In the meantime, this concludes our and our episode, but not our show. What would you like to explore with us next? Please let us know. In the meantime, you can check out our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where we are Conspiracy Stuff and Conspiracy Stuff Show, respectively. You can check out every episode that Noel, Matt, and I have done on Nazis in our website, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. And if all that hubbleabaloo, hillbilly baloo,
yep,
hubbleabilly baloo,
wop ba baloo bop a wop bamboo,
you gotta baloo. Add beluga at
beluga end. Beluga, like the marine animal,
hubbleabaloo beluga.
All right. Well, if you can tell us how to spell any of those words we just said, we definitely want to hear from you. You can write to us directly. Our email is
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. And I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hi, guys. Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.